situation in China. So far, there's still no official confirmation of the reports of the arrest of the radical leaders, including Chiang Qing, the widow of the late Chairman Mao. But our Far East correspondent Brian Barron, who's reporting from Hong Kong, says the lack of official comment is an indication of the depth of the political crisis confronting the Chinese government.
So far, the Peking leadership has not been prepared or perhaps able to sweep away the fog of uncertainty and speculation surrounding the reported arrests. But it is significant that a Chinese spokesman, when questioned by Western newsmen on two separate occasions in Peking, didn't deny the reports of Jiang Qing's arrest. He refused to comment. Here in Hong Kong, reaction among China watchers is cautious, but the dramatic reports are regarded as entirely feasible, a reflection of the rifts within the Communist Party which Mao's death did nothing to heal. Obviously, Peking is under great pressure to say something. The authorities there are well aware that foreign diplomats and newsmen have filed reports saying that Chinese officials at all levels in the capital have been briefed on the attempted coup. It's evident that the crisis came to a head at the end of last week. Until then, all political developments since Chairman Mao's death a month ago had been handled step by step with measured calm. For several weeks, the emphasis had been on unity. But in the past 3 days, an element of tension and uncertainty has become noticeable. Considering the normally strict security and closed nature of Chinese society, it's extraordinary that more news, or perhaps claims is a better word, has come out in wall posters pasted up in Peking and Shanghai in the past 4 days than in the Chinese media. Brian Barron, BBC Hong Kong.
And in another development, it's just been officially announced in Peking that the Prime Minister, Hua Guofeng, has been appointed chairman of the Chinese Communist Party in succession to Mao Zedong. The announcement had been expected for some time, and it's the first time that the same person has held both leading positions in China. The reported developments in Peking so far haven't been announced in the Soviet Union. However, Philip Short, reporting from Moscow, says that any such development would be welcomed in the Soviet capital.
Apart from reaffirmations of the Soviet Union's desire for improved relations with China, there's been no comment here on developments in Peking at any time in the 5 weeks since Mao died. Instead, the Soviet press has limited itself to occasional brief factual reports, and for the first time for many years has suppressed all direct criticism of Chinese policies. However, in the months before Mao's death, Soviet commentators made clear that the Soviet Union regarded the so-called moderate faction in China as very much the lesser of two evils. And to the extent that the power of the moderates has been strengthened and that of the radicals diminished, the events of these past few days can only be welcomed here. Soviet analysts have long predicted that Mao's death would set off a power struggle which would eventually open the way to some kind of Sino-Soviet rapprochement, even if one of only limited scope. And there must now be a temptation for the Soviet leaders to see Hua Guofeng as the pragmatist under whom, over the next few years, that rapprochement may develop. Whether or not that view is justified is another question again. And in the present climate in which the Soviet Union has been trying to give a public impression of maximum restraint towards China, it's unlikely that Soviet news media will give much of a clue as to what the Kremlin is thinking. Indeed, it may well be that the Soviet press will continue to ignore the news from China until the position is clarified by an official Chinese announcement. Philip Short, BBC, Moscow.
Following the military takeover in Thailand, the ruling junta now appears to have started a purge of those of its likely opponents who hold influential positions. Reports of the purge follow the announcement that a former deputy commander-in-chief of the army has been put on the reserve list. A report from our Southeast Asia correspondent, Adrian Porter.
The most highly placed civil servant removed so far is the Under-Secretary of State for Communications, Dr. Gun Nakamti. His wife, who was a civil service inspector, was also sacked. Another to go has been the Director General of the Land Transport Department. Among the broadcasting chiefs dismissed are the Managing Director of the Thai Television Company, the Director of a commercial radio station, and three senior employees of a Bangkok television company. No reason for these dismissals has been given, but it's generally supposed that the people involved were regarded as unsympathetic to the new military government. The junta has, however, now given its reason for the removal of General Challard. According to an official statement, he ignored an order to report to Admiral Sangat Choloyu, the chairman of the junta's National Administration Reform Council, which is now running the country. Observers here noted that the official statement on General Challard also mentioned Lieutenant General Vitun Yazawazde as having been told to report to the Admiral, but that he did so. There has been intense speculation over General Vitun's position. He is Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, but his name has not been included among the 24 high-ranking commanders in the Reform Council. There is some belief that he too may be included eventually in the purge. Admiral Sangat, in a national broadcast, has warned that the junta may have to resort to harsh and severe actions, but that these were aimed at maintaining law and order. This, he said, would pave the way for national security and happiness among the people. A campaign to clean up Bangkok's dirt and general untidiness has been launched, but it's noticeable that punishable offenses include the putting up of what's described as illegal posters and scribbling slogans on walls. Anti-government graffiti has been appearing in various parts of Bangkok in the past few days. Edwin Porter, BBC, Bangkok.
The tentative hopes that Lebanon might at last be moving towards peace have been followed by fresh reports from the Palestinians this morning of a new Syrian offensive southeast of Beirut. Meanwhile, our Beirut correspondent Ronald Robson's been finding out the details of the draft ceasefire agreement being studied by the presidents of Lebanon and Syria and the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And he says there are still many difficulties to be surmounted.
More details of the agreement have become available. Salient points provide for a total ceasefire, withdrawal of armed men to positions occupied before last April, reopening of public highways, and the assumption by the legal authorities of responsibility for military and civil institutions and establishments. There's to be a disengagement or observation force. Palestinians must withdraw to their refugee camps, but some camps have been destroyed. Thousands feel they've nowhere to go. There are difficulties in choosing peacekeeping troops. There could be an expanded Arab League force, but which nationalities would be acceptable? The Syrians, no doubt, are well placed to fill the role, but their very presence is anathema to many. And then, President Sarkis has not yet named a government. The Lebanese army, divided by the war, is not yet ready for certain tasks. The vanguard organization, however, is gaining strength. Men have been deserting factions they joined in the civil war to return to a unified command with Muslims and Christians serving together. There may be a long way to go, but present efforts seem to offer better prospects for peace than have been seen for some time. There are still deep suspicions amongst many ordinary Lebanese that Syria has evil designs on Lebanese territory and really wants to open a new offensive to smash Palestinian armed strength. It can only be said that experienced observers feel that these fears are not borne out so far by Syrian behavior on the whole.
Ronald Robson in Beirut. The Indian Prime Minister, Mrs. Gandhi, has received a warm welcome on her visit to Tanzania. Tony Avagan reports from Dar es Salaam that the visit's been marked by mutual praise of Tanzania and India as third world countries struggling together to beat domination by the big powers.
In speeches at last night's state banquet, both Prime Minister Gandhi and Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere spoke about the need to create a new world economic order. Each leader praised the other's efforts towards this end. The speeches also covered the need to eliminate white minority rule in southern Africa, and each leader pledged to continue support of African liberation movements. This morning, Mrs. Gandhi met alone with President Nyerere for nearly 2 hours. The leaders discussed bilateral matters, but spent most of their time discussing developments in southern Africa, particularly Rhodesia. Another hour was spent meeting with teams of advisors from each country. These advisors will continue to meet for the next 2 days, during which they will try to increase economic cooperation between India and Tanzania. Up to now, that cooperation has been to the benefit of Tanzania, with India providing experts in a variety of fields. Tanzanians tend to regard Indian experts highly because they come with many years' practical experience. But most importantly, aid from India, like that from China, comes from another poor third world country. And this appeals to the Tanzanian sense of third world solidarity. As Tanzania's government newspaper, The Daily News, said today, aid from India has blown the imperialist myth that developing nations cannot help other nations. Mrs. Gandhi will address students at the University of Dar es Salaam, visit the island of Zanzibar, and meet with Tanzanian residents of Indian origin before she concludes her visit to Tanzania. This is Tony Avergan for the BBC in Dar es Salaam.
Here in London, the Minister of Overseas Development, Mr. Reg Prentice, has opened an exhibition of products from 42 developing countries. In his opening speech, he said the exhibition shows that Britain has not turned its back on the developing world in spite of its own difficulties. Here's Andrew Walker.
This is the first exhibition of its kind in Britain, and its object is to encourage imports from the developing countries, hence its name, Impo Expo. The philosophy behind it is that the developing world wants to earn its own living through trade instead of depending on aid. And at the opening ceremony, Mr. Prentice said it showed that for all its own difficulties, Britain hadn't turned its back on the developing world, and he hoped it never would. He recalled that when the government cut public expenditure a few months ago, almost every area was affected except the aid program. Now the government was showing that it was prepared to help developing countries to export to Britain, even at a time when it was making an effort to improve its own trade balance. Criticism of this attitude, he said, was both short-sighted and inhumane. And he made the point that Britain last year had a visible trade surplus with the countries exhibiting of £350 million. The 42 countries taking part come from all parts of the world, ranging alphabetically from Afghanistan to Zambia. The products they're sharing are equally varied. A great many handicrafts, of course, food and drink, jewellery and clothing. But there are more unusual items, chemicals from Algeria and Bangladesh, for instance, electrical engineering from India, Singapore, Sri Lanka and Thailand. Half of the cost of the exhibition has been provided by the European Commission, and the Commonwealth Secretariat has also made a large contribution.
And that report from Andrew Walker brings us to the end of this edition of Radio Newsreel. This is John Gordon in London.
Distribution of Radio Newsreel was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.